I will start by introducing the speakers. First of all, I have Professor Mary Nuboni from New Zealand, a well-known feminist economist and currently Professor of Public Policy at AUT University in Auckland.
In the last 48 hours, I, along with probably some people here, have been chasing the theme of the care economy around this conference. So I've heard differentiations made between the formal and informal sectors, between linked and unlinked workers in the care economy. I've heard or read a lot about volunteer community workers in both NGO and multi-donor harmonized programs presented generally by salaried NGO workers and salaried academics. I've noticed that I've seldom heard from or about the overwhelming majority of those who are the primary caregivers, the 90% or so who are the mothers, neighbours, grandmothers, sisters, who live in the same household or the same compound as those they care for. And in this silence, I've seen perpetuated the discrimination that's manifest in the economic system and which lies at the heart of this universal capacity to exploit women's unpaid productive, reproductive, and service work. Now, to me, falls the burden of getting you through the boring rules. So you're going to have to stick with me. And the rules are really stupid. So if you start to think that you are not getting it, you are. It's not you, it's the rules. So there's a system which all our countries agree to which makes this possible. It's called the United Nations System of National Accounts. It boasts that it's a coherent, consistent, integrated accounting framework for measuring a nation's economy, and that the concepts and the definitions are all internationally agreed. It's the framework which establishes the GDP and measures growth statistics and claims it's designed for, quote, economic analysis, decision-making, and policy-making. So it establishes the units which interact in the economy, and it claims there are five transactors. Now, we're concerned with four of those institutions which all provide health care. Financial corporations, for example, private healthcare providers, government units, public hospitals, and other frontline workers, non-profit organizations, including NGOs and the churches, and private households. Now, to make sense of the system, the rules were made about what is and what is not productive, in inverted commas, for the purposes of the accounts. Now, the activity of production is fundamental. You take a raw product, you add labour, you transfer it to another output of goods or services, and so you have production. Now, many of you will have heard the third speaker this morning in the plenary. And the interesting to me request about the recognition of sex workers. In the system of national accounts, work does not have to be legitimate to qualify as work. All sex workers in any country who have any form of exchange transaction in terms of their work are counted as workers. It does not matter to the economic system whether their activities are legal or illegal. So they are joined along with underground drug smugglers, arms smugglers, people trafficking and women, children, all of those things add to growth. All of those things lie inside what the system establishes as the boundary of production. Really early in the rules, and these are encyclopedic, many countries don't have copies of the rules, which raises interesting questions about how we govern countries according to economic data when we hold the no sets of rules for putting the data into the system. It says all goods and services produced as outputs must be such that they can be sold on markets or at least be capable of being provided by one unit to another with or without charge. So barter is obviously in. It includes all goods and services. This is a quotation. It includes all goods or services provided free to individual households or collectively to the community by government units or by non-profit institutions serving households. Again, our NGOs, our churches. Now, the main problem that this set of rules has always had to contest with was to decide on the treatment of activities that produced goods and services that could have been supplied on the market but were actually consumed in households by members of the household. And so what they decided was, for example, that the production of agricultural goods, which might be bartered, but might also be consumed, would be counted. That the production of other goods, for example, making shoes, making clothing, which might be sold, but might also be worn by members of the household, was counted. The production of what they call own housing services, that simply means that there is a home, very often built completely in a subsistence fashion, but there is a home that provides the roof over the head, so that is called a housing service, and that is counted. But one particular form of activity is completely left on the other side of the boundary of production. That is the production of domestic and personal services for consumption in the same household. So all preparation of meals, all care and training of elderly, children, all cleaning, all repairs, none of these things are considered productive for the purposes of national income accounting framework. Now, what you can see immediately is that there is often very little difference at all between the nature of the work supplied by members of the household to members of their own household. Let's take somebody who volunteers in the community as well. Let's say around HIV, right? So whenever they're working outside their household and doing the same work as they do inside their household, that counts as work. The moment they come home, it's not work anymore. Or I can give you a simple illustration with going to get the bucket of water. These days, walking to get the bucket of water is considered subsistence transportation, and so it's supposed to count. All right. So you carry the bucket of water back home, and your primary task with the bucket of water is going to be to wash down the person living with AIDS, to bath them. All right. So that half bucket of water that you use bathing that person is completely unproductive, and the economic system says that you are at leisure while you are doing that bathing. And then when you use the next part of the water, say to, in the Pacific you'd wash the pig, you might water some parts of the garden, that was very productive, that little bit of water that just got used. Now if you're going to use the remaining piece to wash cooking utensils, if the cooking utensils are the bowl that the members of the household ate out of, that's not productive activity. But if you also cooked some rice or some corn in that bowl and you bartered it with your neighbour, then the actual pot that you did the cooking in, when you clean that, you're actively engaged at work. So I think you can see that this definition is a complete nightmare in terms of how women live their lives. It has, of course, occurred to me that anybody with a BlackBerry these days slips out, in and out of economic production all the time, because when you're sending messages home to the kids, you're not productive, and then when you're dealing with, you know, all the people who are trying to be in touch with you about the conference, then you are productive. And then when you're checking up on mum and dad, you're not productive. And then, you know, this boundary has become incredibly meaningless, I think. Now, I just want to share with you the pieces that it says about health care and the words they actually use, because all this is going to do is just make us even more confused. So at paragraph 153, they talk about final consumption of goods and services for the direct satisfaction of human needs and wants. The, quote, the consumption of health services brings long-term benefits, and even the consumption of basic items such as food and housing is necessary in order to keep an individual in good health and in good working order. For example, goods and services consumed by households, that is, acquired for the satisfaction of their needs or wants, are not suddenly used up and do not vanish at the moment of acquisition. In particular, households consuming services such as health and education may continue to derive benefits over a long period of time. At that point, you've got to say, well, who was providing the services? Remember, if it was non-profit institutions, yes, it was work. If it was that volunteer from the NGO, yes, that was work. If it was a public institution from local or central government, it was work. If it was the private sector, it was work. If it was a member of your household doing exactly the same thing, it didn't count. And this is the substance of the extraordinary universal exploitation of women's labour, either in the AIDS care economy or in the huge range of other activities. In most of the nationwide studies that are done at any time to try and estimate the value of that work, depending on what estimate measure you use, whether it's replacement cost or opportunity cost, you're going to get a different figure. But most OECD countries come out with a figure above 40% of GDP. When you look at the paid or the exchange economy and the so-called non-productive economy in terms of time, time taken over a year, time taken over a week, the non-productive economy always has more work time engaged in it than the productive economy. So that's the underpinning. Now, to get ready for this panel today, I've also used every multi-search engine that the university has available to it and sort of trailed the words care and HIV and work through and read many, many recent papers. And in them, and in the language used in describing the issues for this panel, I have some concerns. So I just get over those very quickly. So the language we have here is, what is the impact of the care economy on women, households and countries? If women were adequately compensated for their work, what would it cost the world? Why is it acceptable for women's work to go unremunerated? Surely if men were the primary caregivers and millions of them were taking on extra duties because of HIV/AIDS, we'd find a way to compensate them. That's true. What will it take to get donors, international NGOs and governments to compensate women for their work? Now, this shares a policy and strategic focus with the first draft concept note I received from the team I'm beginning work with in the Commonwealth Secretariat, which is a research initiative on women's unpaid work in the HIV care economy. And it was remarkable because the two arrived in exactly the same week. And they too are interested in, quote, establishing the importance of policy responses to women's unpaid work in the HIV care economy. So I've a problem with the language of both of these messages. I replied to my Commonwealth colleagues, all of whom have far more experience in HIV/AIDS research than I do, as follows. I'm always anxious about computing or imputing costings as the outcome in the policy debate, because it seems to me that's never an outcome. That's an academic exercise. The nature of the work that would otherwise have been done in the time replaced that was required to carry out the care seems to me to be far more important in a strategic policy sense. We're talking about how do we replace that time that would otherwise have been spent, for example, in food security, rural livelihoods, in the subsistence and informal economy, in the health of the wider family and the population, in barter. Yes, it's a conversation about opportunity cost of being the carer, but in circumstances where frequently the work that would otherwise have been carried out would be informal or subsistence work, therefore inside the boundary of production, And so we'd all finish up having arguments about whether we'd use opportunity cost or specified replacement cost or replacement cost, because the work that we replace it with, of course, largely lies on the other side of the boundary of production. And a far more strategic policy question is to work out how to compensate by policy inputs for the work that cannot now be done, not necessarily to pay for it. We haven't yet convinced health authorities in the so-called developed world to pay for such care given by a member of an immediate family. So we need to be tactical here, and it seems to me that that's the cutting edge of the policy conundrum. I'm mindful of de Guzman's comments that there is a wide variation in local circumstances. Community-led situational analyses are needed to ensure the appropriateness of home-based care or community-based care to the local setting and to define specific support needs. That's about doing it, for example, community by community. So it's the changes in activities, the changes in functions, the time denied, the time stress data that seems to me to be very important, and far more important than any particular academic imputation about the value of this work, which then becomes an abstraction, right? The moment you say, oh, it's worth this much in dollar value signs, and you're trying to make policy around this, you've abstracted it from the real moment-to-moment-to-moment exercise of the care. Right? Yes, there will be some places where direct replacement in terms of money will work, but it won't work nationally and it won't work everywhere. In the Solomon Islands, where I'm working at the moment, 2 weeks ago, I was with the PS for Women's Affairs, and we were out in the province where she comes from, and we went to go to the market where you get fruit and vegetables. And they looked at her and they said, no, you can't have any. You come from fish place. Where's the fish? We can't eat money. So it seems to me we've got to think a lot like that as well. I also wanted to just very briefly raise questions about a rights-based analysis around all of this. Because it seems to me that we have to begin to get very unreasonable about some of this. I've been looking at the possibilities of using the optional protocol for CEDAW tied in with the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights around this issue and around the total exploitation of women. And I've in fact focused on Article 8 of the Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Some of you will know that this is the article about slavery, and so it's very heavy duty there. But it also, in one of its sub-clauses, uses the word servitude. And if you go back to the rapporteur discussions around servitude, they make it quite clear that you would be able to be happy in this work, but you might still be in servitude. That is, having no choices whatsoever to look after your parents, to have your grandmother look after your children if you were going to lose your life. People in these circumstances have no choice about the work that they are doing. And servitude has never been defined and it has never been tested. And so as one of the ways in which we might think very, very seriously about having the world take women's unpaid work seriously is to use one of the most serious international instruments that we can to have some notice taken of that. Thank you for listening, and I look very forward to hearing from my colleagues.